You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, it's Jody, the mom of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We're taking a short pause this summer to enjoy our families and hope you're doing the same. We're also doing some prep work for season two of the Mom and Doc Talk podcast. We've got some really exciting episodes coming your way starting August 27th. In the meantime, we wanted to give you guys the opportunity to catch up on any episodes that you might have missed or take a break. We know you need a break. You deserve a break. Here's a rebroadcast of one of our most popular episodes. We hope you enjoy it.
And welcome to Mom and Doc Talk. We are normally talking about all things health and healing for pans and pandas, but today we decided to jump into another part that's really important ultimately for health and healing for these kiddos, even if it isn't directly related. And that's helping you navigate school and all the challenges that come, because, you know, having a kid with pans and pandas means you're probably going to have difficulty with school. And there's going to be some questions that you've got about how to interact with that. Jody has explored and done some of this on her own. She had to piece it all together, and she didn't want our community to have to piece things together. So she sought out an expert to come in and give us her feedback and answer a lot of questions that were sent in from the community about how to navigate the school. So we're very delighted to welcome Victoria Crisp. Let me tell you just a little bit about her, and then we're going to dive in. So for 25 years, Victoria's personal and professional resume is filled with the factual bullets of helping children succeed. Whether in a specific special education setting, a private charter school, or a traditional public school system, Victoria has been there and done that. Victoria understands families. She empathizes with grace and gets results. Victoria is a change agent. She fights for the children she represents and is determined to get what they deserve. Parents have called her a life changer. Victoria's strengths, counseling skills, being able to cope with distressing situations, problem solving, a caring personality, being empathic, excellent people skills, planning, and decision-making. Pans, pandas, autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, neonatal abstinence syndrome are just a few of the medical diagnoses of kids that Victoria has represented. Victoria lives just north of Boston, Massachusetts, in the infamous switch town of Salem. Oh, that's fun. Victoria is a foodie and loves fashion. She is often seen walking her dog, Belle, who often attends Victoria's Zoom calls with her. And, you know, she might be joined by some other family members if she joins us today. So welcome, Victoria. We are so grateful that you were willing to be generous with your time and come and speak with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just go ahead and get started. We already read your bio, but is there anything else you would like to tell us? Anything more specific about about yourself and what you do?
I mean, I can just tell you briefly that I was a teacher for many, many years. I was a special education teacher. I started in 1997 working in schools. Isn't that wild? And I was a teacher for many, many years. And then I eventually became a special ed director. I'm licensed in Massachusetts as a superintendent, a principal, a special ed director, and all levels still special education teaching. I teach specialized reading on the side. I do, you know, I try to stay up to date as much as possible. And, you know, a few years ago, I decided to give this a go. I thought that given the experience that I had had managing large urban school districts, I thought I could flip it and help families. And that's what I've been doing for the past few years. So, and I love it.
Well, awesome. I can see why Jody sought you out with all of that experience and all different levels of working in schools. So I'm grateful you're here.
Thanks.
Victoria, what's your experience working with PANS families?
So I have had a few cases where the student that of, you know, the family has had PANS or pandas. And I learned about PANS pandas probably about, I think the kid that I am referencing is about 15, 17 years old now. And he was probably about 5 at the time, was the first time I'd ever heard about this. And somebody said, they think he has PANS or pandas. He had strep throat and now he's struggling so much. They couldn't put a diagnosis on it. It was really hard to figure out. And since then, I have slowly started to see more of it, more and more of it come up. And it's, you know, families have been reaching out, because of some of the casework that I've done in Massachusetts, the folks at the, I'm not sure of their exact name, but they're the PANS Pandas Advocacy Group in Massachusetts, sometimes has families that are really in crisis reach out to me for, you know, placements. But we've been able to get some really great results for some of these kids that haven't been in school for either a really long time or are really, really struggling in school, and now they're able to be in a sometimes a different setting or to have the things that they need so they can be successful. So I'm seeing some really good success with the work that we've been doing together.
Fantastic. Well, let's just dive in. As I was sharing with you before we get started recording, I have almost no expertise and understanding, like very, very minimal of all of the different ways that we can support kids in school. So can you just go over for anybody who might be like me and is navigating this for the first time, can you go over the basics of what an IEP is and a 504, some basics about the evaluation, things like what's the difference between the two and what the process really looks like?
Sure. So a 504 is an accommodation plan. So if your student requires accommodations to access the curriculum, they would be put on a 504 plan. There are at times there are some services that can be deemed an accommodation, like speech, OT related services, transportation, things like that. But really, most of the time, you'll see services on an IEP. I should say with the caveat that I am based in Massachusetts. The majority of the work that I do is in Massachusetts. But special education law is obviously federal law, and then states often have layovers. So some of the terminologies that I'm going to use today is Massachusetts terminology, but it should be somewhat similar to other states. But that the 504 is always at the federal level.
Okay. So what's the difference between accommodations and services? Like as simple as we possibly can get.
An accommodation, I think simple is to give you some examples. How's that?
Okay, perfect.
An accommodation is extra time on tests, frequent breaks, a seat at the center of instruction, access to a counselor. Sometimes that gets tricky because now we're talking about designated services versus access to. Sometimes a shortened day or an earlier day. Some of my kids really struggle with the beginning and end of school where it's, you know, a madhouse getting in and out of the building. So at times we could adjust the school day slightly. And that's if they're not getting any additional services. So you need to have a disability and it needs to be, impacting meaningfully. I forget what the exact terminology is, like meaningfully impacting an area of functioning of your life. So you can't just have a disability and get a 504. You have to have a disability that's really impacting your life in some major way. And for kids, you know, going to school every day is their job, is their full-time job. So if they have a disability, oftentimes it is impacting them at school. An IEP has a service delivery. Well, it has lots of things. It will have goals and it will have a service delivery grid. And the service delivery grid is where you'll see special education teacher, counseling services on the grid, speech services on the grid, OT, PT, and it will also have a placement page, the placement page is what designates where the child goes to school. So I do a lot of things, what's called private placements or temporary evaluation placements. And that will, that sometimes goes on the placement page for the IEP. So where the child goes to school.
Okay. And so generally, if somebody has an IEP, do they also have a 504 or is it a one or the other kind of situation?
Yeah, it's mostly one or the other. I've seen and heard people talk about in rare occasions, you might have a kid, like let's say a kid that has a reading disability that also broke his arm and the kid needs to be able to use the elevator or something like that. So you could have a layover 504 on top of an IEP, but usually those things would be significantly not related. Okay. Or like a temporary thing that you need. So we're not going to put use of an elevator or any use of a scribe on a kid's IEP if they have a broken arm. But you might put it on a 504 that's like a temporary ability to access things like that. But it's harder to qualify for an IEP. You have to require specialized instruction. And that's where I think people have to really focus in and understand what specialized instruction is, because a lot of the support that folks are looking for falls under that category, because accommodations are not people support.
That's a good differentiation. Yeah. Okay. So if somebody has something that they need both accommodations and they also need special instruction or specialized people support, will the accommodations be included under the IEP if they're longstanding? Sounds like 504 is more temporary.
No. That was just an example of when you might have an IEP and a 504. Lots of kids are on 504s for long periods of time. And that's the only document that they have.
Okay.
They're only getting that's an accommodations plan. In an IEP, you will have accommodations, modifications to curriculum, and lots of other pages. They're like 20 page legal documents about how your child's going to be educated. But if you want your child to be seeing a grown up for support, specialized services, that's going to come in the form of an IEP.
Okay. What makes it so much harder to get an IEP versus a 504?
Well, first of all, there's a different criteria. So to be found, we call it the eligibility process. So to be found eligible for an IEP, you need to have a disability. You need to not be making effective progress. You need to, the lack of effective progress has to be related to the disability, and you have to require specialized instruction. To have a 504, you just need to have one area of life, of functioning, that's impacted by your disability. So one's a little a weightier process to receive eligibility for. I work mostly with IEPs. Okay. If folks are coming to me for help, they probably require a higher level of the service. I mean, sometimes districts will deny 504s, but I mean, to be really honest with you, to think about it like this, 504s don't cost the district anything.
Right.
IEPs cost money.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So they're easier to get.
That makes lots of sense. And then one more question for me, just so I can make sure that I'm really fully understanding all the basics, is where does somebody need to go to get get recognized as having a disability to even begin this conversation? Because I assume that that has to be in place before the conversation is started.
Yes and no. Yes and no. So you go through the evaluation period. So oftentimes the families that I work with, it depends on how old the child is and how long folks have been, you know, going through this process. Oftentimes people will have multiple years of school-based evaluations and a neuropsych and documentation from their doctors. If you're brand new to this process, you might show up to the school and say, my child needs help. So what you do first is you say to them, I need an evaluation. How do I request an evaluation? But what's really important about that is to not get put off by somebody. Our teachers say, oh, I don't know, I think you need to see a doctor first, or I don't really know how to request an evaluation. You have to find somebody at that school. The day that you want that evaluation, you have to find somebody, you have to put it in writing, you have to sign and date it. And then they will send you out a consent, and then the child will be evaluated. Through that process of evaluation, there'll be lots of different tests depending on what the areas of concern are. And then you go to your first eligibility meeting and the team finds the child eligible. So you can come to the team with a disability. Pans pandas from a doctor. You could be seeing a specialist for years and years. But that doesn't mean that you're going to be found eligible as having a disability for an IEP. So you still have to go through that initial evaluation.
Okay. And then one last question for me, I promise. And then we'll get to all the questions that were submitted from our community. So when you say you want to start an evaluation, is it just like you talk to the teacher, you talk to somebody in administration? Who is it that you talk to say, I would like an evaluation?
It varies from school to classroom to classroom, school to school. But what the important part is, yes, you can start with the teacher, but sometimes depending on, you know, how the districts operate and how knowledgeable the teachers are, and how well-meaning the teachers and administration are, they can say, well, let's just try some things first. And then you're 6 months down the road and you still have no evaluation. And the evaluations take 45 school days to complete. So the minute you decide you want an evaluation, you have to identify somebody in that school district and say, I want you to send me a consent. I'm writing a letter. I'm putting my name and my child's name, student ID, birth date, and I want an evaluation. So that could be, I mean, certainly you go to the district special education office. They're going to know that they need to do it. You go to your school's administration, and sometimes you might be able to go to a teacher, but I might go above that to request an evaluation to make sure you get it right when you get it.
Okay. I think I got the basics now. Thank you.
If Victoria, if a parent would like to learn the basics ideas of what a school district must do and are not allowed to do, where would we start?
That is a tough question because this is nuanced, complicated stuff with multiple layovers. If this, then that, not this, but that. I mean, it gets complicated. I've been doing this for 25 years and I'll say, you know, somebody will ask me a question like that. Like, can't you just tell me? I'm like, no, it's taken me this long to learn all of the different facets of this. So I can't explain it to you in like a little nutshell. It's very complicated. I mean, there are some really good websites out there that you can look at. The state has resources. The federal government has resources. There's a website called Understood that I think is really good and helpful. And you can your district should have some kind of, in Massachusetts, we call it a CPAC, Special Education Parent Something Committee. So I think most states have that in their, you know, special education laws and regs. But yeah, if you really want to find out for what your child needs and can get, and you're able to, I would call a professional.
Yeah, you're talking to the best community for that because you're almost explaining homeopathy. There's so much nuance to it. It's so unique. How it works for one kid doesn't necessarily work for the other. There's just lots of factors and lots of things that as parents we have to learn that we don't understand, that our providers are the professionals that know what they're doing, know how to do it. So we definitely understand that there's a lot to that answer in the different states and everything. So totally get that.
And much like being in health and medicine, everything that we talk about on this podcast is always, we're trying to do as much as we can to like general education to help steer people with making decisions. But obviously you always need to work with like somebody for your own specific situation, which leads me to my next question, Victoria, which is when really does it make sense for somebody to bring in an education advocate when they're looking for accommodations? Is it best to do it like right from the get-go, or do they try it on their own and then only bring things in after there's a problem?
I mean, my answer is always going to be from the minute you are requesting something from the school district, you should find somebody to go with you. And you should find somebody, preferably, who has as much or more experience than the other people you're sitting across the table from. Yeah. Because when you go into these meetings, there's six people in these meetings, okay. Five of them are across the table from you. And most of them have master's degrees in education, special education. They work in the district. They do this every day. They have hundreds of meetings that they go to. So they know what they're doing. And you really need somebody to say, hey, wait a minute. That's not how this works. Or no, we're not going to wait. Or this is what we need now. And, you know, if they're not willing to budge in the meeting, how to push back in writing after you get the documents. Like, you know, if it's not an outcome that you were hoping for.
Yeah. Kind of makes sense to me that, so when I went through this with my daughter, I got really, really lucky. I just happened to land on people that were really understanding, a couple of them that knew what PANS was. I didn't have any struggle, but it makes sense to me to bring in an advocate the second you realize that there's starting to be a struggle, or in the beginning, if you possibly can, but if there's any struggle whatsoever, it seems like taking a pause and bringing in an advocate would be a good idea before it gets tangled up and gets more difficult. Is that right?
Yeah. And I'm going to even take a step further. And this is just, these are my thoughts. Obviously these are my thoughts on this, right? There's also folks that are parent advocates, that are parents who have gone through this, that are now trying to help other parents. And I think that there's a place for everybody in this world of helping others, but be careful what kind of advice and help that you're getting. So folks will come to me and think, oh, I don't really have that big of a problem. So I don't need to cause a big scene at school, or I don't need to be in a big conflict with school. So it's not really a big deal. So I probably don't need you. And I'll say, okay, well, this is how it works and this is what we're going to do. And then they'll be back in 6 months. And somebody else has already been in the case and made decisions and responded to things. And I'm like, that makes it so much harder to go back for me to kind of untie some of that to get things where we need to be. So I would say find the right person.
Yeah.
Not just find anybody. And as soon as you get really good advice, the sooner you're going to get the outcome that you're looking for.
I can't agree with you more, especially when it comes to, you know, all things PANS and PANDAS, right? Like the reality is the more we try and DIY it when it comes to like health or like taking advice from other parents who've done it, who don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of the specifics of the condition and the individuals themselves. And I can't tell you how many times I see kids come in worse off and like, as you said, it takes more to untangle some of the stuff that was done because of advice from somebody who didn't have expertise than if they would have just come to us in the first place and gotten the ultimately where they wanted to go faster and probably end up costing less in the long run.
Oh, for sure.
No, you go ahead.
Sorry. I think that mothers want to reach out to other mothers who have been going through it as a support system. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important to find as many people as you can to support you to the point where you feel supported. That's important. If you want to get stuff done, you got to call me. I am supportive, but I'm also going to get you what you want in the end.
Right.
So they're different. It functions differently.
Yeah. And I think that it, beyond just the wanting to work with or like have community and like have somebody that they can lean on and who understands that, I 100% also agree. There's huge, huge, huge value in that. But there's also importance in recognizing that, like, you're one, like you said, the quality of the advice, the level of advice, the level of support that you're going to get, how quickly you're going to get to the outcomes that you're looking for, but also recognizing that, like, when you're dealing with a kid with PANS, you are so overwhelmed, so overexhausted, so depleted that it can be hard to navigate these things. And there's a lot of nuance to it.
So hard.
And to try and like do that when you're exhausted and depleted and like overwhelmed and just like your life is just overtaken by
turned upside down.
Yeah. It's like, there's no, I just don't see how anybody could possibly do this on their own.
I've had moms say that I work with that are clients, long-term clients of mine, say, you know, there were so many people that wanted to like come to my house or bring me coffee or give me a hug. And like, I was really appreciative of that. But like, I got to a point where it's like, I need somebody to fix this for me.
Yeah.
Like, I can't live like this anymore. We can't live like this anymore. So, I mean, I might buy you coffee, I might give you a hug, but I'm also going to fix it for you, right? So that's what people really need. That's what you need, is you need somebody to solve the problem.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm going to ask this question from one of our community members, and this is actually something that's brand new to me. So I don't even know what I'm asking. So I would love the basics of this as well. What are the pros and cons of OHI versus ED categories? My kids are OHI, but I have a good friend whose older child is ED, and it protects him a little differently. My kids qualify under OHI due to absenteeism.
Okay. So I don't know this family, and I always get so nervous. So I'm going to preface what I'm going to say with, I'm going to try to keep it kind of high level, because I don't want anybody to feel misled or disappointed if what I'm saying doesn't exactly apply to them. So what do they say? The 10,000 foot view.
Yeah. 30,000 feet.
30,000 feet. That makes more sense. Okay. So OHI stands for other health impairment. Massachusetts, we call it health impairment. And ED stands for probably emotional disability. Most of the time now you hear it called emotional impairment. You can have a health impairment for a lot of things that are health related. ADHD also falls under health impairment. Asthma. Anything that you think straight like doctor, medical stuff health impairment. Emotional impairment is anxiety, depression, OCD, any mental health conditions. Then there's also neurological. Underused, one of my favorites. If you look at it, it's a fairly broad definition. It involves the brain, obviously, right? And so many of these conditions, especially when we're talking about neuroinflammation, or if you've seen a neurologist, you might qualify under neurological, which is, you know, like I said, one of my favorites. So I think that what she's maybe asking here is one better? And I don't think so. So once you're qualified, you're qualified. You don't need to have an emotional impairment to qualify for counseling. You don't need to have a health impairment to qualify for access to the nurse's office or, you know, any other medical things or absenteeism. You can get whatever your child needs based on whatever disability category the team has found them eligible under. What you hope for is that the team has made the right determination. The other thing that I will add to this is that they don't qualify kids under things like PANS, PANDAS, and sometimes they won't even qualify them under things like dyslexia, because those are diagnoses and not disability categories. So like PANS, PANDAS can be other health impairment or emotional impairment. Dyslexia falls under specific learning disability or specific learning disability in reading. And it's not going to say dyslexia on it. It might say it in the narrative, but it's not what they're qualified under. That's a different term. That's, you know, the health impairment, neurological or emotional impairment. And due to absenteeism, I mean, if the child qualifies for accommodation, services, tutoring, home, you know, now we have all the, you know, being able to do school on your computer, like whatever the districts have to offer, it doesn't, I don't think it matters what their designation is. I think that what the designation ends up being is usually a result of the most presenting symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually what I was just going to say. It sounds like it mostly, it's like the difference between diagnosis and symptoms. Like you're going to be getting support for symptoms that you're experiencing, not because of the diagnosis that you have. Right. And part of what you shared earlier too, was that it has to have impacts in the school setting, right? So you can't just be like, I have PANDAS, but I'm doing great at school, but I'm going to get an IEP because I have PANDAS. Like it has to be, I have PANDAS, and because I have difficulty with whatever happened, you know, the cognitive impairment that can come with PANDAS, that I need special support and I need like somebody to help read with me separately. Right. Because my cognitive impairment leads to me having rage or whatever that happens to be. So if somebody's doing great, but they're going to not get an IEP, but if they have an IEP for not for PANDAS, but for cognitive regressions, that then are like reading disabilities that come along as a part of it, then that is what they'll get some support for. Is that correct?
Yes. And you can have three disability categories. Mm-hmm. So you can have a health impairment, a specific learning disability, and an emotional impairment. Lots of kids that I work with have more than one.
So I have this just came to mind, and I'm curious because of the fluctuating nature of PANS and PANDAS, how it, you know, relapses and remits. Does that make it harder for people to get an IEP if it's needed because of the fact that it might be like they were in the middle of a flare for like a month and it was horrible for that month, but then they got better and then they're doing great again. Like, does that impact their ability to get services?
Yes. I mean, short answer, yes. Mm-hmm. Longer answer, depends on how long they've been dealing with it. Has the school been paying attention? Have there been multiple flares and now people are noticing a pattern, so it seems less like an isolated incident? And how severely have those flares impacted their school functioning? Because maybe they have a flare, they're out for a bit, and then they come back and they're lost and they're behind and they really require that support. And then there's a couple of flares and they're out for certain periods of time. So, you know, this is, as you know, these are ongoing issues. These can last years, right? Decades in some cases. I mean, the good news is that I've had kids that are doing fabulous and don't need their placements anymore and don't need their IEPs anymore. I always say don't give it up until the last minute, just in case. But I mean, but when you need it, try to get it, because it makes a big difference.
I would say, like, we see kids all the time with, you know, through healing with homeopathy and everything, that are able to completely give up their IEPs. But same thing, we're like, keep it until you absolutely don't need it or when you're going.
Yeah, I mean, even drop the service delivery down to like 30 minutes a week. I mean, that's fine, but you still are qualified. I mean, you can always go back and get requalified, but I never advise it if you're able to kind of hang on to it so you don't have to go through eligibility again.
Well, it sounds like because of the, what we just talked about, like the flare nature, that making sure everything is documented early. And would it be important for people to bring somebody like you in like the first time that they're recognizing that this is what's happening, even if it's not necessarily going to be likely to qualify for services yet? Is there support with like getting things documented appropriately?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I mean, it's unfortunate. Listen, I am a public school person. My mother was a kindergarten teacher for, I think, something insane, like 40 years. I have been in the districts since I was in college still. So I love public schools. I'm going to say some not so nice things about public schools, because it's not going that great, right? It's just not going that great there. And I hope they do a better job. And sometimes I like to think that I'm helping them to do a better job. I don't know if I am or not, but I mean, I certainly have spent a lot of time trying. Mm-hmm. I always consult with families first, because I want to get the whole entire story. And so if you work with me, I'm going to do a big intake. and I need to see you on Zoom. I need to talk to you. I want you to email me all your documents. I want you to tell me the whole entire story. And as you're telling me the story, I'm going to be like ticking off things in my head, because I'll be like, meets this criteria, meets that criteria. We need to get this. This is, I'm going to follow up more with more questions about this. Like, how can we use this information? That's what I do. And then when I go to school, I put all the, when I go to schools, I put all this information together and I know where to start. So either I'm going to say, we need to start with an evaluation, or we go to them and say, we already have this evaluation. Or, you know, I might go and say, I know you already did an evaluation. You found the child not eligible. I'd like to reopen eligibility because here's this new information. Mm-hmm. So there's all these like kind of technical ways that you can approach these cases. And that's, I think, if you just go sometimes and ask for it, they're just going to say no.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer. But, and I mean, other times, Jody, I'm like so happy for you and that you had an easy time with this. And this is not to say that there are not really amazing people that work in these schools, and people are really trying hard. And, but there's also a lot of people who've never heard of Pants Pandas. I think in Massachusetts anyways, there's people who like kind of like don't believe in it.
Yeah.
And there's people who are just overwhelmed. This is a hard job. I mean, teachers have 25, 30 kids in front of them. That's 60 parents in some cases. Who all these kids have a ton of needs. We've been through the pandemic. There's lots of kids with absenteeism. I mean, everything has just gotten harder for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could definitely see, Dr. Barr kind of touched on it earlier, is if I would not have had an easy time, I very likely would have said okay if they said my kid didn't need accommodations, because it was just one more fight I would have had to do that I wasn't capable of doing at the time. And I had an easy time. And even with that easy time, I had so much anxiety about this meeting because I had no idea what was going to happen, what to expect, anything like that. But had somebody said no, I very likely would have been like, oh, okay, like we'll figure it out. And just because back then, this has been, it's been a long time since my daughter was diagnosed, and she's recovered now and doing well and healthy. But back then, education advocates weren't talked about so much. I didn't even know that an education advocate was a thing. So I love that there's more now and we're talking about it more. It's good stuff. How can a parent best communicate their child's needs so that a teacher will understand and not be overwhelmed with the complexity of PANS and PANDAS?
I mean, that's a tough one, because it's a complex thing.
Yeah.
And you don't know if this teacher's ever even heard of PANS PANDAS before.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of that's going to depend on who the teacher is and how much experience they have. And if it's a general education teacher, they might not even understand special education that much, because that's not what they're trained to do. And if you're talking to a special education, you'd have to go, if you're starting with like a severe special education teacher, they would know. They know a lot about kids with all different kinds of syndromes and very severe health complexes, and they would understand how this applies. If you're going to your child's like gen ed math teacher, they're probably not going to know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that IEPs and 504s are above the teacher level. So you can talk to the teacher and say, you know, Johnny is struggling with these things. He's under the care of a doctor. But you know, that's only going to get you so far. If it's starting to impact grades, functioning, attendance, because these things snowball, right? If you're missing school or assignments or getting in trouble at school, you only have a few opportunities before you ask for intervention, so those things don't become big problems. So usually you're going to want to go above the teacher level to talk to somebody about what's going on. There's this other thing called a health plan that can be written with the nurse. Those are often for kids who require some kind of nursing assistance in school. So if kids need to take medicine in school, or, you know, I've had kids that have had feeding tubes in school and they're in wheelchairs and they need all sorts of medical support. But that might be another avenue, depending on, you know, what kind of, I think it's good to find the right person. Mm-hmm. And that might be a nurse in this case. Mm-hmm. And it might be a counselor.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. And I think that you can only provide, you know, you can go to the same places where you can Google it, right? And you can send them emails. Here's what this is. But you're limited in what parents can't dictate what the professional development schedule is going to be for the school or who's going to pay for it. I mean, you could go to the CPAC and say, you know, I think this would benefit a lot of families, but you can only do so much advocacy. And at some point, you might not have the bandwidth for that if you're going through it. When you're really in it, you might just want to buckle down and focus on what your child needs.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, I'm thinking about when I drop my kid off, and my kid's in preschool right now. And so she's got four teachers, and it's not like I can just sit down and have a chat, like a long chat with any of her teachers. And this is, you know, not one teacher for 30 kids. This is four teachers for 24 kids, you know? And I think back to the days that when I'm from a long line of teachers. My mom was a teacher. So lots and lots of respect for teachers. And like, I can't imagine, you know, my mom who would go above and beyond and long days and whatever. There's just not the capacity necessarily for even the most caring teacher to be able to stop and sit and like learn all about every single kid and their special needs and like the challenges that are coming on. I appreciate that you share that, like, we can't, parents can't dictate what our teachers are going to learn and like what their professional development is going to be.
Even if you're on a committee, there's 10 other people voting with you about that. I also think that teachers are like almost never the problem. Like, this is a district issue. And that's what I you know, try to remind folks to think district level. The district is responsible for your child. The district is responsible for upholding the civil rights of your child if they have a disability. It's not the teacher's responsibility. It's the district. The teacher is a representative of the district, but so aren't everybody else that works there.
Right. And I think that the reality is we just need to maybe give the teachers a little bit of grace in this situation, because the question being about not wanting to be overwhelmed by the complexity of PANS or PANDAS, like, it's overwhelming for one parent, or even a parent, you know, multiple parents in a household, dealing with one child with PANS is a lot. Like, I don't even know how my heart goes out to my kids' teachers, because I don't know how like they deal with all of the 4-year-olds in the class at one time. And like, so it's going to be complex. It's going to be overwhelming. I don't think that, like, as much as we want to try and like make things as easy as possible, it's just going to be hard. And I think maybe like accepting that it's going to be challenging, and that there's some value in that is all I'm trying
to
say.
What I would not advise people to do, even if they're so inclined to, which I have known families who start off this way, is just sending people tons of emails to read links. Yeah. Pages and pages of things, accommodations you give my child. This is what my child has. Why don't and then getting more and more mad when they don't understand it, and getting more and more frustrated. And the teacher's probably like, you know, why is this family sending me 20 emails a day about this thing? I have things to do. That's why it's important to go through the right channels to get what you need. Don't get frustrated. Don't waste your energy, time and energy on other things. Just like,
yeah,
figure out what you need and just go for that goal.
Yeah, I just always tell people, imagine if, especially like with doctors too, like, imagine if every single parent was emailing the length of things and the amount of things that you're sending. Do you think that you would ever have time to even talk to you for your case? Right. And this is, you know, for a teacher, you're talking about people who are overworked and underpaid too. And then you're like piling more on. So good advice. Thank you.
So I think this question probably falls a little bit under the same category that we've been talking through, but going to go ahead and ask it anyways. How can parents best convey that some behaviors are out of their child's control despite what they look like?
That's tough. That's another tough one. And there are, regardless of what your child's going through, regardless of what your child's disabilities are, there are rules and there are consequences. And that's life.
Yeah.
And to not reinforce that is very bad for children's psychology. However, if a child is properly supported and receiving the kind of instruction they need, smaller group perhaps, a slower pace, access to folks who are you know, psychologically minded, who understand these kids, what makes them tick, how they function, gives them a wide berth. I mean, there, it's an ounce of Prevention is worth a pound of cure. I feel like I'm trying to come up with like sayings that I don't really remember exactly what they are, but you want to make sure the child is properly supported to try to reduce some of these behaviors. You don't want to say, my child went into school, tore it up, did all sorts of crazy stuff. Why don't you just forgive them because they have a disability? Because it's not going to probably work that great. But what you want to say is, Johnny needs this kind of support in order to be successful. This episode the other day was evidence of the fact that he was not successful because he was not properly supported. Mm-hmm. And that, so it's, you tell me why Johnny had such an explosive day. How were you supporting him when this happened? Is this the second incident, the third incident, the 30th incident that's come up? What's the school district's plan for how we're going to support him to be successful? I'm his mother. I'm at home. I'm at work at my own job. What you tell, how you, you know, that's a good way to get a kid qualified, especially if the, I mean, the squeaky wheel gets oiled. There's another saying. You know, if you have a kid with a lot of behaviors, and boys are always more physical than girls, girls are kind of and there's kids that are internalizers and kids that are externalizers. You have a kid with that's a big externalizer with what we call big feelings, that kid's going to get qualified faster.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounded almost to me like you just took something and you took like you, it, you took the emotional component and you turned down the volume on the emotional component. And you turned up the volume on the like action component, like factual and action component. And I'm wondering if that's one of the main, like major things that you help to do other than navigating the system and knowing what needs to happen. But if you're almost like an intermediary that like the parents can give you the emotion and you take that and you find the facts and you apply the facts to the case and help like turn the emotion down.
1,000%. I mean, this phone right here is blown up nonstop with parents that are like, can you believe what happened the other day? And I'm like, yeah, it's happening everywhere. I have hundreds of people that are on my roster right now. And this is what's going on. So yeah, I believe it, but it's happening to your child. So it's very distressing. Tell me what happened and I'm going to write the email.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a quick way to, if stuff is happening, that's a really easy way for me to flip it back on the district if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. All right. So I got another bunch of questions that we're going to go through here for from our community. This might be another one where is like sort of a specific question that you may or may not be able to give specifics to, but as much general information you can give us would be great. So this particular person said, besides helping teachers to understand how symptoms present and how the student is likely to feel when symptoms are present, it would be helpful for teachers to have specific practical strategies to help students when they're struggling. I know reducing stress and stimuli can be super helpful, but what other strategies can teachers have in an action plan to help students? It sounds like a parent is trying to plan on like what they should be asking for.
Yeah. So I would Google accommodations for kids with PANS pandas. Honestly, I mean, that's a cheap answer maybe, but that's what I would do. And then you're going to find lists that people have already, you know, populated, written, put on the internet. Some of them probably better than others. I mean, I can even do a little research and link some to this if you want. And then I would look through the list and say, this is what I want. But this has already been done. So you don't have to recreate the wheel from like the beginning. Definitely use what's already available to you. And accommodations are very easy to find, very Googleable. What's realistic, what the school will accept and what the school's going to be able to implement, that's different. Also, not everything is doable in a room of 25 kids and one teacher. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind, because depending on what you're asking for, we might be talking about more. We might be talking about services and we might be talking about a different setting.
Yeah. I just want to give a reminder really quickly that we did do a recording a while ago without an expert where Jody was doing her mom advice and sharing her experience that's available on YouTube. So we'll put a link to that video. Where Jody shared her experience and the accommodations that she was given that she was able to negotiate for her daughter. So if anybody wants to take a look at that as well, that's available for people. Like I said, we'll link it in the show notes.
And back on that specific question, that's literally exactly what I did when I was DIYing it. I went into the, you know, the general PANS groups and I searched accommodations and got lists of accommodations to see what other parents had asked for. So I didn't have to come up with any, I just had to like plug it into my kid's symptoms and figure it out from there.
So. Yeah, exactly. Good job.
All right. So another question from our community. What real life strategies have you found successful in helping kids with PANS or PANDAS return to school and be successful year round? This particular person said her son's school has come up with some out of the box ideas to help her keep him there. But this is both of their first times figuring it all out. So are there specific real life strategies that you find successful?
I mean, that's a really tough question. Return to school and be successful year round. When you have a team that's willing to wrap around your child and that's willing to edit and revisit the plan that's in place and tweak it when, as this works, this doesn't work, let's do more of this. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for an active, flexible team, somewhat of a living, breathing document that can change, not the IEP itself, but like maybe a behavior plan or a support plan or something like that. I have a kid who doesn't have PANS PANDAS, and that teacher, I mean, I'm sorry to all the teachers out there that I'm going to say this to, because I think she's going way above and beyond. She makes videos for the student to come to school the next day. She'll preface the day and say, "We really can't wait to see you tomorrow." And she sends it to them every day.
Oh, wow. Knows.
So, I mean, that's the biggest thing that I've ever seen. Not everybody's going to do that. I mean, this woman is like a saint.
Sorry. That like gets me.
Oh, I so know. Much. If you start crying, I will too. Cause it's like, really, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing what some people will do because they care so much about these kids. But what, it's a really hard one to answer because, again, I'm going to say a lot of this, if a kid has struggled long enough and hard enough with this, they might need another setting before they return to a huge, big public school setting. So it really depends on what kind of, is your child in a little private school? There's probably a ton of flexibility. Does your child go to a 4,000 kid high school? Less flexibility. They can't individualize every child in that high school's experience. They just can't. So what's the setting and how flexible is it? And how available is the team and how invested are they? So those are all the things you want to look for. I don't have a set thing that I can tell you that's going to work for your child. I wish I did. I mean, if I knew the kids individually, I might be able to, through a process that can take a year, I could maybe figure it out, but there's no magic pill, bullet, anything for this.
I'm super curious because you were talking about this, like the flexibility of the team. And you said sort of what I was thinking, and you said it out loud, which was like a living, breathing document. But at the same time, like it's like a 20-page legal document, like you said. So yeah. Is it something that is changeable or like so how frequency that it can be changed or updated?
Not that document. So okay. They might be like layovers or plans. Okay. Like we might have, there might be an IEP that has all this stuff laid out in it, but there also might be like a behavior plan or some scripting for the staff to use when speaking with the child or, you know, there's a line on the IEP that's specifically laid out for consultation. And that's the opportunity for these providers to get together and talk about what's working, what's not working. So it might not always change the IEP. 504s are much easier to change. You don't need to meet with the family. You don't need to have them signed. If the school thinks some accommodation is going to benefit the child, they're supposed to put it in there. Not everybody knows that, but that's how 504s work. IEPs, you can't do anything without the full team convened, unless you, on rare occasion, you write an amendment and change the IEP within that year. But there are all sorts of plans, written plans, plans that teams follow. And then, you know, you don't really want to put it into maybe an IEP until you get the right mix. And maybe the child's presentation is changing. The seasons are changing. It's the beginning of the school year. It's the end of the school year. There's all these things that can like interfere with functioning and kids' attendance and how kids are feeling or doing. Or so, you know, finding the right team that's invested in your child and making it work is what you want to be looking for.
So it's more like the living, breathing documents are like the supporting tools, like around the IEP. So the IEP is like, here's what has to be done, but there are tools that have flexibility around that, or like conversations that there's flexibility in how those things are accomplished. That is what you're wanting to look for. Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
I feel like I have to go back and address my 5-second ugly cry there and say something that you, Victoria, you've already said is that got me so much because that's basically what happened with my daughter. There were certain people at that school that were willing to go so far above and beyond what anyone should expect for a child. And I feel like, you know, for a second pausing to say that I hear these stories quite frequently. I think teachers in general want to help us and the capacity that they have to help us, they're willing to do. And so I just want to send lots of love to any teachers that might be listening to this, that are those people that are just doing extra to help our families get through this. And I know there's some, there's so many really, really amazing teachers that help PAN's families get through this. So just...
And I'm also going to throw it out there that, you know, the same thing is true with healthcare providers, that some healthcare providers will go above and beyond. And in my experience, and Jody, you can like correct me if I'm wrong in your personal experience too, but in my experience, the times that people have gone above and beyond for me have been the times that I've not expected it and definitely not when I asked for it. And there's something that like really changed when you have expectations of that. So hope for the best. Working with people to understand that they're people too with their own challenges.
So I would like to add one little line to that, Jody, is that a lot of my clients are teachers and administrators. So interestingly enough, kids, families, mothers usually who have kids with disabilities know what should be going on and know what they do for other kids. And then they want other people to do that for their kids. Mm-hmm. So this isn't a, I mean, you know, teachers know better than anybody how hard teaching is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that just speaks a lot to like just the importance of working with somebody like you. If people who are already working in the system are like coming to work with you, that just speaks to the value that it really provides to work with somebody as an advocate.
Yep. What is what has and hasn't worked for other educators when it comes to making accommodations?
Other educators?
Yeah, like in your own personal, I mean, I think if I'm reading the mind of the person who asked this question, like what have you seen in your conversations or negotiations with things? What have you seen that's been effective for people?
I think way too hard for me to say based on the, you know, the variety of students. I mean, I have been to thousands of IEP meetings. And these are, the I in IEP is an individual.
Yeah.
So I can't say there isn't anything that's gonna, you know, be good for everybody. So it's what works for one person is not gonna work for another. And there's, you know, hundreds, you know, so many things that we could consider accommodations. There would be no way for me to figure that out. I can't think of anything that I would say, oh, you know, this definitely never works. I think trying, caring, those aren't accommodations though, right? That's like good intentions and trying. And if you don't have the capacity to try, you find somebody else in the district who can, or, you know, or you go out of district.
Yeah.
That's something that an educational advocate sticks with you through, right? Like what works, and then we figure out what doesn't work. And then you still have your advocate with you that kind of like navigates that whole process.
Oh yeah. That, I mean, I do that based on an individual basis. For individual clients, I go through the whole entire process with them. I just can't, you know, say for your whole entire wide audience, these accommodations work, these accommodations don't work. That would be impossible. And it wouldn't be the right thing to do, even if I thought some accommodations weren't great, because they might work. They might be really helpful for some kids.
Yes. I was just thinking that would be not just impossible, but irresponsible, which is why, like, you know, in our community, we don't give, you know, ideas about, you know, homeopathic remedies that can be helpful, because homeopathy has to be just as individualized as an individualized education plan, because it has to be for the totality, like the specific things that a person is experiencing and the totality of their case and their environment and all of the things that are going on. And it would be irresponsible to give somebody ideas for things that they could, that might work or that might not work, when the reality is like the thing that would, we say doesn't usually work very often might be the exact thing that would work for that particular kid.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So I wish that I had heard this less frequently, but I've heard so many parents share with me, they've got an IEP, and then like parents are just like, as they're going through and sharing about how things have been going last month, and like, and they didn't follow this and it's in their IEP and all that. So what should parents do if the school's not following the laws and meeting the accommodations that are laid out in the 504 or the IEP? And how can somebody like you help in these situations?
Reconvene the team. Call the special education designee and say, we have to reconvene the team. This isn't working. The child hasn't been getting the services. I don't believe they're getting the accommodations. They're continuing to not do well in this environment. Absolutely reconvene the team. I mean, I would say give it enough time to be implemented and to be able to maybe gauge whether or not you're seeing anything come of what was put in place. Mm-hmm. You can't do it like 5 days later. You can't say, oh, this isn't working. Right. But like, I mean, I always say, you know, you got to give it longer than you'd probably like to. But stay on top of it 100%. And there's also in IEPs as opposed to 504s, people will say to me all the time, I don't think my child's 504 is being followed. And I'm like, is it that the 504 is not being followed, or is the 504 not strong enough, not weighty enough to support your child at this point? But also what I like about IEPs is that there are goals. So it's the district's responsibility to help that child meet their goals. So when you look at read an IEP goal, it's going to say, you know, Johnny will do this 30% of the time and 4 out of 5 times. Now, what are those? I mean, it's not the greatest way to write a goal, but you'll see that a lot. But there is some metric that makes this a measurable goal. And is the child meeting that goal or not? Mm-hmm. Because that's another thing we want to look at, because if the child, we're always looking at, does the child require more? Mm-hmm. Or is this enough to support them? And you'll know when they start to be successful.
You have to tell you, it's so, I didn't expect to have as many opportunities to like cross-reference homeopathy in our conversation that we've had today. But like, just, this is another one of those things where like you're talking about making sure you give it enough time to see if it's effective, and like, you know, evaluating whether or not you're making progress, even if it's not perfection, right? And that's just another place. I feel like the things that we could give, if we could wrap up a little gift to give to every PANS parent, it would be patience and willingness to see the plan through before making another step. And it's hard. It's really hard, you know, as I'm looking at Jody and like thinking back to when you and I first met, it's hard to have patience because you know, this is so overwhelming and so hard. Yeah. And it's still necessary.
Yeah. And patience is one of the things that produce the best outcomes.
Yeah.
In the long run. Yeah. And over again. So what's the best course of action to begin district change in policy? Where do we start if the district policy and guidelines are an obstacle to your child's accommodations, to getting their accommodations?
That is against the law. You can't have policies that stand in the way of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, you know, there's lots of things. I have filed there. I had a kid who had a few disabilities. One of them was panspermism. We filed a major Office of Civil Rights complaint and won. The main topic was around bullying. And because of that complaint that we worked on, the district had to change their bullying curriculum, implement a new bullying curriculum, train everybody in it, you know, get the school committee to sign off on it, get every single teacher and employee in the district to sign off on it. And that kid goes to private school now. I am not a lawyer. But you know, if you know what you're doing, you don't need to be a lawyer to do this. It's better almost if you're, in my opinion, for some of the stuff, sorry, lawyers, if you're an educator, because you really fully understand what it's like to work in a school, and in a district. So there's all sorts of different ways. There's, you know, the special education comes with these protections called due process. So get your parents' rights brochures, read through them, read through the federal government, Department of Education's website, read through the Office of Civil Rights, read through your state's information on special education and your due process rights. Everybody has them. It's laid out under federal law. So there's that you can do. You can join advocacy groups. Like if your state has like a PANS PANDAS advocacy group, if your state has a special education advocacy group, you know, if you're interested, there could be like lobbying days, on the state capitol. You know, there are opportunities for advocacy. Again, not high level, consultancy, advice, but Google it. Google it to find out what's available in your area. And if you're passionate about it and you have the bandwidth, go for it.
Yeah. So it sounds like if the policy and guidelines are not such that the accommodations that your child needs, that maybe is it the concern that maybe somebody's has needs accommodations that aren't recognized in the law, that the law itself needs to change? And that's where, like,
I don't think so, because the standard is going to be, does the child require this? Mm-hmm. If the child requires it, then they get it. Where parents bump into, you know, issues is by saying somebody that your child doesn't require this. But there shouldn't be, it would be against the federal law for districts to have policies mm-hmm. that violate the Americans with Disabilities Act or civil rights or, you know, education laws and regs. You can't do that. These things work together. What's going to be the problem is if the district says that you don't qualify and you don't get access to that because you don't qualify, but there shouldn't be like a policy that interferes with a child that has a designated disability that's recognized by the district getting something that they require. I mean, I guess there are things, I mean, there are rules. There's, you know, there's compulsory attendance rule laws in Massachusetts. I think they vary slightly in all of the different states, but in Massachusetts, if you are a child that's under 16 years old, you have to go to school every day. That's it. That's the law. Mm-hmm. So parents bump into attendance things, but there, you know, that's when we have to get into really documenting and coming up with a plan and making sure everybody understands what's going on and, you know, that this is covered, because not with pandas necessarily, but, you know, if kids are out a lot, you know, the schools have to call DCF, the Department of Children and Families, and file abuse and neglect, because it's considered abuse and neglect to not send your child to school if they're under 16 years old. So parents get really mad about that when their child's sick, but that's why it's even more important to make sure you have the right documentation, make sure you're working with somebody who knows what they're doing, so that everybody in that scenario is protected. And not only that they're protected, but don't forget the part about your child missing their education.
Yeah.
Because that's as important as it is to follow the attendance laws.
Yeah. All right, our last question that we had submitted from our community, you've already touched on this, but I'm going to try and like distill it down a little bit. So basically, it's somebody who's a nurse and is wondering if there's a way that training could be made mandatory for teachers to learn more about PANS and PANDAS. And she references that educators are familiar with autism and ADHD, but not as much with PANS and PANDAS. So I'm going to change her question just a little bit, because I know that there's no way, you've already shared with us, there's no way parents can dictate what the continuing education is. Do you know anything about the history for how it was advocated for to get more education about those things teachers, so that maybe PANS, PANDAS advocacy groups could follow similar trajectories?
It's a long time. We're talking decades.
Yeah.
I work with in this kind of niche area of autism, which is girls and autism, fairly frequently. And people don't know the difference. And people say, well, everybody should know about autism now. I'm like, well, there's a lot to know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different presentations, different types. They've changed the diagnoses for these. So, you know, it's hard. I mean, how long have people known about ADHD and autism? I mean, if I was deep in the world of special education, I only heard about this 17 years ago. There's probably a lot of people who have never, ever heard of it. And if you are not there is a big gap between general educators, regular educators, and special educators. And, you know, is it more important that everybody in the district is trained in rules-based reading, which is like the phonics of reading, the building blocks for how children read? Or is it more important that, you know, thousands of teachers learn about PANS, PANDAS, because there might be four kids that have it? So, I mean, that's going to be the odds that you're up against. So I think that the thing that I will add to that is, if you're a parent who has the resources to bring in something or someone, so in cases of working with me, I could potentially be the first person educating this team of people on what PANS, PANDAS is. And people will say, oh my God, remember we were in that meeting with that lady talking to us about PANS, PANDAS? And like, what, you know, they'll say, like, once they have that kind of, the teachers, the staff have that light bulb moment, oh my God, we finally listened. We finally put into place what this kid needs. And then that kid was successful. When we hear about this again, maybe we'll do the same thing we did last time. Because ultimately, everyone's relieved when the kid starts to be successful. But I mean, change is slow. Mm-hmm. And that's how I think what the real issue is.
I think it's probably as slow as it is in the medical community. We are 20 years behind the medical, like the research, what's happening in practice. So what's happening in practice today is just now catching up to the research from when I was an undergrad a long time ago.
Same. It's slow. It's slow. But, you know, it depends. What resources do you have? What's your bandwidth? Mm-hmm. You know, who can you reach out to? Do you want to donate something? Do you just want to start, you know, change starts at home. And that they say things like that, right? Like bring somebody into a meeting and talk about what your kid needs. And then that can have a ripple effect.
Yeah.
Go speak at the state capitol about your experiences with it. So there's all different ways that you can kind of bring awareness to it. And then you hope it catches on that some more people want to learn about it.
Yeah. And I see that thing very slowly happening because it's been 8-9 years since we entered into the PANS world, and there was literally nothing. And this is one thing I love about the parents of the PANS community is there is so much advocacy going on and so many different groups doing so much good work. There are people like I see it in other groups talking about, you know, going into schools and educating, going into hospitals, educating, trying to spread the word. So I think it's like I've always said this about medical. It's us moms telling our stories, advocating for our kids. That has been what I have seen make the most progress over the years. And it's not fast enough, but it is happening because we're telling our kids' stories and we're trying to lovingly teach other people what is happening to our families. So the people that are coming behind us, unfortunately with this, they're going to be aware because our kids, our families have already walked through it.
Yeah,
for sure. Families will drive the change in this area without a doubt. And I think, you know, this grows and snowballs.
Yeah.
So the, you know, you might have, I don't know, would you have 25,000 people in your Facebook group now? You might have 100,000 not too long, because all those 25,000 people might tell one other person, and then that one other person, think about how that works. I mean, so, you know, you're probably going to see faster, more rapid change, but it's not going to be the rate of whatever. Everybody would like everybody to totally understand this and empathize with everything that they're going through. It's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Victoria, we are so grateful that you were willing to come and walk me and my absolute non-experience through all of the basics and then answer some of the higher level questions for parents who've been in the trenches for a while. Your expertise and your information and education is unbelievably valuable. So I'm very grateful for the time that you've been willing to share with us. How can our audience get in touch with you if they're looking for support or potentially wanting to engage with you?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. I hope that some people find what I said today to be helpful. If you would like to reach out to me individually, I have a website. It is crispeducationadvising.com. And also you can email me directly at the, it's Victoria@crispeducationadvising.com, which I think you're going to put a link to with the video. Yes. And you're welcome to reach out and tell me a little bit about what's going on. And I am taking clients from all states, at least to do consultancy work.
You read my mind.
Yep. I will take clients from all states to do, you know, to do some degree of consultancy work with families. And then, you know, after we talk and get into it a little bit more, we can figure out like, you know, how far we're going to go with it. But I think that, yeah, I mean, if folks want to have a consultation, I think that, you know, could be really helpful to a lot of people. So I hope that if they're struggling and they need some help, that they do reach out.
And like you said, we will absolutely put links to your website and your email and everything, any way that they can find you in the show notes. So take a look there if you wanted to reach out to Victoria. So again, thank you so much for your time and your generosity with your expertise today. We really
appreciate it. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for the work that you do.
Thanks
so much for asking me on today.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.